rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
986 days, 12 hours, 54 minutes, 37 seconds, 35 seconds, 33 seconds, until George Bush leaves office voluntarily, that is, barring impeachment. Welcome back to our program, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Yesterday I lost it with a guest. I've never gotten so much email in my life. It's just about a show segment. This from one of our listeners. You called him a bigot. That was telling the truth, not hurling a label. I've heard you from years now and know overall you're incredibly measured and fair. For just once, it sounded wonderful to hear you tell it like it is. Thanks for having these bigots and other fools on the program. I do learn from the experience. That's interesting. Sarah, thank you very much for the email. I much appreciate it. Speaking of weird stuff going on, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, yes, the people responsible for making sure that your food is safe, have been given talking points by the Bush administration where every time they make a public speech about things like whether or not there's E. coli in your hamburger, they are supposed to say, quote, President Bush has a clear strategy for victory in Iraq, end quote. The U.S. Department of Agriculture. Weird stuff. And speaking of Iraq, Britain is expected to release the names on Monday of five soldiers who died on board an army helicopter that came down in the southern Iraqi town of Basra. An Italian soldier seriously wounded by a roadside bomb in southern Iraq on April 27th, has died, according to the Italian news agency. He died along with three other Italians and a Romanian soldier who were killed in that same incident. They died before he just died. And the following, the latest figures for U.S. military deaths since the U.S.-led invasion in March of 2003. United States, 2,418 dead. Britain, 109 dead. Other nations, 111 dead. And the best guess for Iraqis, these are the most conservative numbers, the Iraqi military between 4,800 and 6,300, the Iraqi civilians between 34,700 and 38,900. And these are from IraqBodyCount.net. Just FYI, and as I said, they say on the website, this is probably an underestimate of the true casualties. So that's what's up. Also in the news today, this from the Associated Press, yesterday, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences came out with a new edition, and in this new edition, the National Academy of Sciences, lesbians' brains react differently to sex hormones than those of heterosexual women. An earlier study of gay men also showed their brain response was different from straight men. An even stronger difference has now been found in lesbians. The team of Swedish researchers published in Tuesday's Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. In both cases, the findings add weight to the idea that homosexuality has a physical basis and is not learned behavior. What they did was they exposed men and women, straight and gay, to the pherons. They don't have any smell to them. But these chemicals that people excrete, humans do just like every other animal. And what they found, the same team reported last year on a comparison of the response of male homosexuals to heterosexual men and women, they found that the brains of gay men, and this isn't like asking them, what do you think? This is like, you know, they've hooked up brain scan monitors to them, and they're actually looking at their brains firing. They found that the brains of gay men reacted more like those of women than of straight men when exposed to the pherons of men. And the new study shows a similar relationship between the response of lesbians and straight men. Heterosexual women found the male and female pherons about equally pleasant, while straight men and lesbians liked the female pheron more than the male one. Men and lesbians also found the male hormone more irritating than the female one. So, interesting, interesting study just out. Speaking of this topic, David Tebow is with us. He's the editor-in-chief of the Cybercast News Service, CNSnews.com, one of the more conservative-leaning news websites out there. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. You don't really believe all of that mumbo-jumbo that you were just talking about, do you?
Well, when it comes from a scientist and it's published in the Journal of the National Academy of Sciences, which is a peer-reviewed publication, I tend to take it seriously. Tom, the guy I had on yesterday had his...
Studies are done by both sides, all sides, and it supports the view that they want by the way they ask the questions, by the way they set up the survey. It's all self-perpetuating and self-fulfilling. And the conservatives do it, too.
Yeah, we had this guy on yesterday who says that he's got this study now of 77, you know, couples showing that gay couples have gay children. And you ask him, okay, did you actually do a study? No. Well, what is the study of? Well, I bought three books on Amazon.com, and I analyzed the information in those books. Well, what were the books? Well, the books were stories of gay couples raising gay kids, and they were intended to celebrate being gay. And right. So a lot of these gay couples had gay kids. This is, and this guy is actually, you know, he actually bamboozled the Oxford University Press to publish this thing. I mean, it's amazing.
I just don't give much weight to any of the surveys that are done by these so-called think tanks today because I think they all have an agenda.
Well, but this is not a survey. This is actual hard science that is published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Yeah, I listened to your description of it. I still think it's mumbo-jumbo with a preconceived notion.
So you're of the opinion that being gay is a decision, not a biological...
I think it's a combination of things, Tom, and I think the environmental factors are things that you just cannot overlook.
So on June 6th, the United States Senate, in all probability, is going to vote on a bill. This, in my opinion, this is the conservatives getting ready for the November election. So we've got to trot out guns, gays, and God, right? They're gonna vote on a bill to amend the United States Constitution for the second time in the history of this country to limit the rights of citizens of this country. The first time being back in the 1920s when they banned alcohol during Prohibition. Uh-huh. And you think this is a good idea?
I don't. That might surprise you, Tom. I do not believe it is a good idea to amend the United States Constitution to protect the traditional institution of marriage. I do believe that the individual states, just as I believe individual states ought to have the right to ban abortion, I believe that individual states ought to have the right, if they choose, to ban homosexual marriage.
Why?
I think it ought to be left at the state level. I don't believe that the U.S. Constitution ought to be changed for this issue.
Why should gays be forbidden access to the legal things that come with marriage? I mean, I can understand, and I would is that you, that crashing noise that we're getting?
No.
David? Boy, I don't know if that's the, Tim, you can tell me, is that coming off the ISDN line or is that coming off the phone line? You think it's coming off the phone line. David, we're going to try something here. I'm going to ask Tim to drop you and call you right back. Actually, Tim, just pot him down for a second first. And if I'm still talking and we're not hearing the crash, and then it's the phone line. It's not the ISDN line. David, we're going to have to call you right back and get you back on here because I do want to have this conversation with you, but that phone line does not work. We've got some kind of, you know, weird funky noise there. So Tim will call you right back. And while he's doing that, I'll just, you know, lay out my thoughts on this. Actually, I'll save that for when you come back. Just a couple of things around these issues. And again, this, you say, hey, this is, you know, what's the single issue stuff or what's the deal? Gays and lesbians are running for legislatures in Alabama, Arkansas, Oklahoma, re-election in Idaho, Iowa, and Oklahoma, North Carolina, and Utah, according to USA Today, an article by Andrea Stone here today. All states whose residents voted predominantly for President Bush in 2004. I see this as good news. I think this is a good thing that gays are getting involved in the political process. They're saying, hey, wait a minute, we're human beings too. And we're members of society too, and we're citizens too. The article points out, USA Today article points out, opponents of same-sex marriage say gay activists fear that if Congress passes a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage, they will have to fight ratification in the states. And the problem is it'll only take 38 states to support ratification. I believe it's 38 that would have to support ratification. And you've got at least that many states now that have passed some sorts of limits or have, you know, a good chance that could happen. And so, you know, people are, in fact, they're, you know, this is, people are saying, no, we're going to get involved. In fact, in 2004, 11 states passed ballot initiatives banning same-sex marriages. Gay activists have been shocked at how badly they've done at the state level. David, you back with us?
I am, and I'm sorry for whatever technical reason
Yeah, it's probably Alberto Gonzalez. You know, he's got to say, Alberto, get better listening device. Oh, it's Michael Hayden. That's who it is.
I assure you, I wasn't clanging dishes in the background.
Yeah, no, I don't. You couldn't hear it.
I could not.
Yeah, that's funny. It was just crashing really badly on this end. But I want to continue this conversation with you, and also I want to invite our listeners to participate in it. If they'd like to give us a call, our telephone number 1-866-440-8466. Should gay marriage be banned at law in the states? And obviously I think not, and David thinks so. You can share your opinions with us. David is with he's the editor-in-chief of Cybercast News Service, CNS News. .com. We'll get into the actual discussion of this right after this break. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
Too late to fight.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. It's never been tried before. The Bible doesn't mention it. Civilized people have never done things this way. No society in the 6,000 years of history since civilization has suggested such a thing. It'll create social chaos, ultimately destroying the nation. It's just too radical an idea for people to accept. These all arguments put forward in 1770 against the United States splitting away from England and declaring itself a democracy. Later trotted out in the 19th century over the issue of freeing slaves, in the 20th century over whether women should be allowed to vote, in the later 20th century over whether women should have full rights in the marketplace, in the business place. And in the 1950s, whether the Supreme Court should force public schools to allow white and black children to attend class together. Now, once again, we're facing the same issues. George Washington said in 1790, as mankind becomes more liberal, they will be more apt to allow that all those who conduct themselves as worthy members of the community are equally entitled to the protections of civil government. I hope ever to see America among the foremost nations of justice and liberality. George Washington, a man who proudly called himself a liberal. Welcome back. David Tebow with CNSNews.com, Cybercast News Service, on the line. David, tell me why gays should not be allowed to marry.
Well, I'm not going to say that homosexuals shouldn't be allowed to marry, although I don't personally believe that.
Then why don't you tell me what you personally believe?
Well, I separate it, Tom, because I think it's very important to let the states decide for themselves what they're going to do. And that's why.
So why should any state be allowed to ban gay marriage? I mean, I don't believe in Ganesh, the Hindu god, but that doesn't mean that I don't acknowledge that somebody has the right to worship Ganesh.
Okay, well, I'm going to tell you about my own personal feelings in a second, but I think just as you have 18 states that currently have state constitutional amendments barring homosexual marriage, and you have 27 states that have codified bans against homosexual marriage, meaning that 45 of the 50 states have taken action, it should be at a state level. That's why I do not believe that you need an amendment to the U.S. Constitution to essentially bar homosexual marriage. I mean, they call it the Federal Marriage Amendment to define marriage in traditional terms, but what we all know it is a ban against homosexual marriage.
But you realize that the argument that you just made is the exact same argument that was made in the 1960s against passage of civil rights legislation.
Well,
this should be left up to the states.
Let me get to my personal feelings.
Let's just keep those African Americans in their place. After all, let's just leave it up to the states. They know how to do this.
Okay, fair point.
Let's just keep those gays in their place.
Let me get to my personal feelings, Tom. I believe that race is an immutable characteristic. I believe that freedom is an immutable characteristic, and I do not believe that homosexuality, much less homosexual marriage, is anything approaching immutable.
What does immutable mean?
That means that it's inbred. It is inherent. It's part of your fiber. It is what it is, and it should be. That's what immutable is.
So the argument that was made by the majority of politicians and the majority of states in this country for a about the first 150 years of the existence of this country.
They were wrong.
That African Americans are immutably different.
They were wrong.
What if you're wrong?
Well, I don't believe I am.
But what if you are?
Well, I mean, you're asking me to conceive of, a different opinion. I guess opinions change over time. But Tom, I don't believe that it should be framed along these terms. I mean, if there are two people who love each other who happen to be homosexual, I'm not going to stand in their way, and I'm not going to seek to discriminate against them.
You're going to stand in their way of being able to visit each other in the hospital, of being able to inherit, of being able to help make medical decisions, of being able to raise children?
Any more than I would stand in the way...
You would personally, if you would support a ban at the state level against gay marriage.
Well, but you can get those benefits without homosexual marriage, Tom.
How?
You can get those benefits if you extend them to everybody, just as you would have an aunt and a niece or an uncle and a nephew or a grandfather and a grandson or any combination that you can think of.
Well, I don't think that, uncles, an uncle and a nephew want to get married. I mean, marriage is a very specific institution. There's hundreds of specific legal rights that come with marriage.
But, Tom, you were just talking about inheritance and the right to visit somebody in a hospital. So
those are two out of maybe 300.
What's that?
Those are two out of maybe 300.
Well, what do you want to talk about? Because if you're talking about those certain benefits, you don't need to have marriage.
What I'm saying is that I have no problem with the Catholic Church saying we will not marry somebody who's gay in the church any more than I have no problem with the Catholic Church saying, as in theory they still do, we won't marry somebody who's been divorced. If you want to defend marriage, in fact, I'd say if you want to legislatively defend marriage, make it a crime to have affairs. Make it a crime to get divorced. I mean, as many countries have done, actually. But
it's not a crime to be immoral.
It depends on where you're living.
In many ways, it's not. It's not criminal.
It depends on where you're living, and it depends on how you define morality. But my point is leave it to the church what they're going to decide is marriage. But in terms of civil things, we're talking about a civil society here. That people should have these civil rights.
They should not have a right to get married if they just decide, I want to get married.
We'll pick this up right after this. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Tuesday's edition of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The brains of all three groups were scanned when sniffing male and female hormones and a set of four ordinary odors. Ordinary odors were processed in the brain circuits associated with smell in all of the volunteers. In heterosexual males, the male hormone was processed in the scent area, but the female hormone was processed in the hypothalamus, which is related to sexual stimulation. In straight women, the sexual area of the brain responded to the male hormone, while the female hormone was perceived by the scent area. In lesbians, both male and female hormones were processed the same. In the basic odor processing circuit, Savick and her team reported, each of the three groups of subjects, healthy, unmedicated, right-handed, HIV-negative individuals. So they tried to take out all the variables here. Bottom line, lesbians' brains may act like straight men's. This is the same team that recently found that gay men... their brains react to human pheromones the same way women do. We're talking with David Tebow. He's with CNS News, CNSNews.com, Cybercast News Service, the editor-in-chief. And, David, you were just telling us why gay people should not have the right to get married, civil marriage.
I don't think that the traditional act of marriage should be abridged willy-nilly by anybody who is homosexual or polygamous or anybody else who would alter the traditional form of marriage, which is the nuclear family, which is the backbone of this country.
That's actually not the traditional family.
The most successful country on earth.
That's not the traditional form of marriage. Marriage has been around as an institution, if we go back to biblical days, let's say 6,000 years. And, you know, you can, I mean, we can get into pre-literate societies if we want, but let's say 6,000 years. And for all but the last few hundred of those 6,000 years, it was, you know, and the Bible, you know, says it was polygamy. David had 700, no, it was Solomon had 700 wives. David had multiple wives. I mean, it was in the New Testament, Paul says, you know, if somebody's going to be a deacon in the church or if somebody's going to be a member of the church, it would be good if they only had one wife. It would be, you know, better thing. But he doesn't mandate that. The idea of only having one wife is a relatively recent thing. Also, if you want to look at traditional marriage was never interracial and was never interreligious. That's actually specifically banned in the Bible.
You heard me stipulate about the traditions in this country. Now, do you really believe in polygamy?
I'm ambivalent about polygamy.
Do you think we ought to legalize polygamy?
I have known people when I worked and lived in the Middle East, or when I worked in the Middle East, I spent enough. I can't say I lived there. I knew Arab families where, well, we knew one in particular where, you know, the husband had four wives, and it seemed like a very functional, very happy family to me.
In the United States, should we legalize polygamy?
That's not the point. My point is that you're claiming traditional marriage, and I'm saying the tradition of marriage predates the United States by about 6,000 years.
Well,
and if you want to
traditional marriage,
okay, well let's just talk about traditional marriage in the United States. Up until the 1960s, it was a crime in most states for people of different races to marry. That was traditional marriage in the United States.
Those laws were wrong.
Well, I would say that laws banning two men or two women from marrying are also wrong. Let's see what our listeners have to say about this. Mike in Claiborne, Oklahoma. Hey, Mike, you're live with David Tebow.
Hi. I was curious as to why is it that if gays and lesbians get married, does that mean I have to get a divorce if they're allowed to enter a civil marriage?
I don't understand the question.
I think the core of your question, Mike, is how does it affect me? I mean, why does David Tebow care about this? Why should I care about this?
Right. Yeah. If they can get married, I mean, how does that affect everybody else? Does that mean that you can't? That straight people are no longer allowed to marry, or that we have to get a divorce?
It's because if you
do women get married?
It's because if you dilute, if you abridge, the tradition of marriage, it lessens the power of marriage for the people who do it in the traditional way.
How?
If I've got two gay guys living next door to me or two gay women and they're married, how does that dilute my marriage?
Well, it just changes the entire social fabric. It allows all kinds of things to spring up from it.
What, freedom?
Well, you can call it freedom. I'll call it dysfunction.
Okay.
All right.
Mike, you make a good case.
You're dysfunctional, dude.
Thanks a lot, Mike. David in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, David.
Hey. First-time caller. I love your show.
Thank you.
I live in Wilton Manors, which is one of the fastest-growing gay cities. You can hold hands down the street and stuff like that. It's in Fort Lauderdale.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to ask your guest a question.
Go for it.
Which may make him see things from my perspective. Okay, the question is, how long, this is hard to say, how long have you, when did you decide to be straight? That's my question.
When did I decide to be straight?
Yes.
Well, probably around the time that I snuck up to my big brother's bedroom and took a look at his Playboy magazine.
Okay, so before that you were undecided.
Well, I don't believe in teenagers having sex, and I don't believe...
Oh, I didn't talk about having sex. I said, when did you decide upon your sexual orientation?
Sexual orientation was with me from the beginning.
Let's call
it. Yeah, what do you think it is for me?
Well, you know, you can live your life the way you see fit.
No, I'm not living my life the way I see fit. I'm living my life the only way I can.
So, David in Fort Lauderdale, let me ask you a question, and perhaps this will help David.
I haven't finished with my question.
Okay, go
then
for it.
Then you can ask your question.
Sure.
My question is, when did you decide to be straight? And you said, when I read a magazine. But then you changed it and you said, oh, no, it was before that.
Well,
when
I suspect
did you decide?
That, I suspect that it was with me all the time and I grew up in a normal childhood.
There
so
you
I did not veer off into dysfunctional behavior.
All the time. Why do you think that is?
I did not veer off into dysfunctional behavior, which
so
would have tended to make me,
wait,
you know, experiment with homosexuality.
Okay, you didn't really answer my question. I asked you when you decided.
Yeah, no, we got that. David, this is Tom speaking, and speaking to David in Fort Lauderdale. I'm curious, David, did you, throughout your life, even as a child, feel that you were not male or that your orientation was more gay than straight, let's say?
Yeah, I mean, I remember I was very, very, like, into comic books. And, you know, I always remember, like, you know, the Superman and the way they draw them and everything. They make them look so good.
Finding that attractive. Now, even as a little kid.
Yeah, I remember, like, that as a little kid, you know.
So, David Tebow, here's somebody who says that he was born gay. I mean, are you trying to say that David just decided one day that he was going to do something that was, you know, going to put him in a position where the rest of society was going to diss him and give him a hard time and make his life miserable?
See, Tom, you're putting me in a no-win situation by making me look like I would discriminate or be a bigot toward David.
Well,
if you're going to forbid
David from marrying somebody that he loves, I would say you are.
Well, I don't believe that he ought to marry another male, because I believe that that would help to ruin a traditional.
Tell me one example of how it ruined someone that you know, how it would ruin someone. One example. One thing that would be bad. Tell me one thing.
Well, all right. I'll give you a very good example. It's something that we've covered recently. Do you know that the supporters of polygamy now want...
I'm not talking about polygamy here. Keep on.
Well,
if
you open up marriage to homosexuality, what will follow immediately will be polygamy.
No, come on. That was the argument that was made.
And all this stuff. I want one thing, because it's been in Canada for quite a while, and it seems all right. It's been in Europe for quite a while.
Are you going to let me talk? What will follow homosexual marriage will be polygamy and then pedophilia.
Why hasn't that happened in Canada and Amsterdam then?
You're going off on other things. I'm talking about gay marriage. I'm talking about two people that love each other, that want the same rights as you.
And you don't want
someone in the hospital to get their social security.
You don't want to admit to the slippery slope.
Huh?
You don't want to admit to the slippery slope, and that's what's going to take place.
Yeah, David Tebow, you're not David in Fort Lauderdale. Thank you very much for the call. You made your point. You made it very well. David, you're not acknowledging the fact that gay marriage has been legal in a number of countries for a number of years, and we're not seeing an explosion of pedophilia or polygamy or any other weirdness in those countries. In fact, life seems to be going on just fine. Thank you very much. I was living in Vermont when civil unions were allowed. You know, were signed into law by Howard Dean. I remember the Westboro Baptist Church out there with their misreading of the Bible. You know, of course, the reality is God hates figs. You can see that over at GodHatesFigs.com. You know, Jesus cursed the fig tree. But they were standing out there with their God hates fags signs and things. And we had civil unions, and we didn't have an explosion of immorality in Vermont. There still isn't.
You will have an explosion of the other types of whatever relationships you want to call them once you legalize homosexual marriage across the board.
Then why haven't they in Holland?
Check out Amsterdam.
I've been there.
Functional behavior that.
Okay, we'll be back in just a second. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I see people turn their heads and quickly look away. Like a newborn baby, it just happens every day.
I look inside myself and see. glad.
And welcome back, my friends. Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, on the Discovery Channel, there will be a one-hour special that is based on a book that I co-authored. So check it out. We put a link to the Discovery Channel promo on it at the top at TomHartmann.com. You can just click that link and get over there. We're talking with David Tebow of CNS News, Cybercast News Service, CNSNews.com, the website. David, our lines are slammed. I've got 10 callers here, and the board is totally full, and there's more trying to call in. So what I'm going to do is just pop through here and ask people just to, you know, give, because we only have about 7 minutes here, ask people to just give a sentence or two of their point, and then I'm going to move to the next one, and we'll take three or four of them, and then I'll give you a chance to respond. How's that?
Okay.
Because if we try and get into one of these conversations again, we just, you know, one person. So, Fred in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Hey, Fred.
Hi, Lenny. Are you a Christian, David?
Yes.
You are.
Number one,
if you're a Christian, according to Christ's thing, you'd worry about your business, not worrying who's sleeping with who.
So, what happened to the old, speck in your eye and a mote in the other eyes? Thank you, Fred. Dave in Portland, Maine. Hey, Dave.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Appreciate the program here. Hey, listen, I got a quick theory, and I'll drop it, but why don't the gay agenda, why don't they just worry about getting the civil marriage down, the civil union?
That's what I'm talking about.
And the states, why don't they stop recognizing marriage since it's a religious ceremony?
That's not going to happen because the word marriage is written into thousands and thousands of laws. It would just be unwieldy and impossible. Dave, I can answer that one. Ray in Seattle. Hey, Ray, what's up?
Hey, my point was very similar. I think that in a free society, marriage should be a familial contract between any two people, regardless of their sex, age, whatever. Like he was saying, your nephew could be your heir, even if you weren't blood related. And that somebody's physical relationship should be out of the picture.
But marriage also legalizes sexuality in the United States.
That also should be abolished. That's ridiculous.
I see. Okay. Interesting idea. Gary in Cleveland, Ohio. Gary?
Yeah, I'm not gay or nothing, but I thought we lived in a free country. Apparently we don't. I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I got your point.
We built a house for a couple of lesbians, me and my dad.
Uh-huh.
Best customers we've ever had. They paid their bill. No problems out of them. They love their house.
Okay. Thank you, Gary. Gene in Louisville, Kentucky.
Yeah, Tom, I just want to ask, since 50% of conventional marriages end in divorce, wouldn't by the same token 50% of gay marriages end in divorce? And by the same token, wouldn't divorce lawyers be able to capitalize on gay marriage misfortune just as they would conventional man-woman misfortune?
Another business opportunity, in other
words.
Right. Okay. Leanne in Evansville, Indiana. Hey, Leanne.
As one of those bill-paying lesbians,
mm-hmm.
I really just don't understand why straight people really even care. I think this is nothing more than another election cycle hot-button issue. And if me and my partner of 9 years want to call it whatever we want to call it other than marriage, great. Leave us alone. We'll pay our bills.
But, Leanne, what happens if your partner goes into the hospital and a decision has to be made on pulling the plug or inheritance, things like that? I mean, isn't that a reality that you live with?
Oh, yeah. The reality is I would like to have a legal agreement. I don't care what you call it.
Right.
So you can call it
a civil union just as easily.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And this is nothing more.
I'm with you.
In Indiana, it is a huge hot-button election issue. And after the election, not one peep is said about it.
Yeah.
It's exactly like on the national level. Not one thing was said after this last election.
Well, we have an election coming up. Leanne, I got to move along.
Thank
you for the call. Tom in Minneapolis. Hey, Tom.
Hey, David, you were talking about slippery slope and polygamy. Got a question. Studies and statistics show that conservative, evangelical, heterosexual males commit most pedophile crimes. Should we outlaw those kind of marriages? Slippery slope.
Okay. At that point, David, I'll toss it to you. You've got a bunch of pieces there, and we still have a whole bunch more callers. If you can be fairly quick, we can go back to some more.
Well, I'm not an evangelical. I'm a Catholic, but then you're going to mention the priests.
There you go.
Actually, Tom, I agree with several of your callers, but I'm not worried about who's sleeping with who. I am worried about the invasion on the traditional concept institution of marriage in the United States. I think it's a tradition that has done this country very well. It has created a nuclear family that has allowed the prosperity.
Would you have a problem, David, with allowing civil unions all across the United States?
I don't have a problem with benefits that allow inheritance or, as you mentioned, people to see loved ones when they're in the hospital or things like that.
So a civil union that is identical to marriage in all regards except it doesn't use the word marriage. You have no problem with that?
Well, I think that the institution of marriage ought to be a heterosexual mom, dad, and the kids kind of arrangement.
So now we're about semantics.
It's not just about semantics. I believe wholeheartedly in the nuclear family, a male, a female, getting together, getting married, and having children.
Okay.
That's the nuclear family, Tom, whether you want to admit it or not. And that is the backbone of this country and the prosperity in this country.
Jerry in Rutherford, North Carolina, quick comment.
I'd just like to know how many documented cases of heterosexual divorce there are that were where the family was torn apart by a gay marriage in another state.
Probably a fair number, but that doesn't.
Wait a minute! You think that because the guy down the street got married to his lover, that I'm gonna say to my wife, Louise, it's been nice knowing you. We've had a good 35 years, but I'm checking out.
I think that anybody who is going to leave their spouse for a member of the opposite sex has really got some problems.
You mean for a member of the same sex? That's my point. Is that straight people don't break up because a gay couple got married?
There are all kinds of different elements to this, Tom, but I
okay.
keep coming back to the central fact that you can't argue the success of the nuclear family.
Okay, David Tebow, Cybercast News Service, CNSnews.com, the website, a new article there by Monisha Banshall, specifically about this June vote on the marriage amendment. David, thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome, Tom.
It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, George W. Bush's approval is falling through the floor. When you look at midterm elections, interesting what you see. This in USA Today, actually, a nice tight little summary here. The House of Representatives. In the midterm election of 1966, LBJ only had an approval rating of 44%. He lost 47 seats in the House. Richard Nixon in 74, approval rating of 24%. He lost 48 seats in the House. Ronald Reagan in 82, he had an approval rating of 42%. He lost 26 seats in the House. And Bill Clinton in 94, he had a 48% approval rating and lost 54 seats of the House. This apparently is what happens when the president's job approval rating is below 50%. His party really takes a whack. And it's interesting to see how these things are being played out. And in fact, of course, as his party is preparing to take a whack, it seems to me that life in the Bush economy, fat, drunk, and broke, Paul Craig Roberts' new piece. He says, a nation of waitresses and bartenders. It seems as the economic statistics, as the economic reality of America is becoming more and more evident. And by the way, one dimension of that, the Washington Post reporting this morning, and this is, truly mind-boggling, the Washington Post, Jonathan Weissman and Shalig Murray, this is just the first two sentences of this article. It summarizes the whole thing. A $2.7 trillion budget plan pending before the House of Representatives would raise the federal debt ceiling to nearly $10 trillion, less than 2 months after Congress last raised the federal government's borrowing limit to $9 trillion. The provision buried in page 121 of the 151-page budget blueprint serves as a backdrop to congressional action this week. The United States Senate, by the way, looking at these kinds of very serious problems and being a Republican Senate, did actually act today. They actually held a vote and they actually voted on something. They voted on a resolution saying that if the Star Spangled Banner is sung in the United States, it should be sung in English. I kid you not. I am not making this up. Oh, my. So, what about this great economy? Bureau of Labor Statistics, the numbers released May 5th, what is that, Thursday of last week, said the economy created 131,000 private sector jobs in April. Isn't that good news? 10,000 construction jobs, 8,000 in natural resources, mining, logging, 19,000 in manufacturing. I mean, it seems like it should be good news. But the bottom line is, the economy actually has 10,000 fewer manufacturing jobs today than we did a year ago. As Paul Craig Roberts, the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, the Republican conservative Paul Craig Roberts, a former editor at the Wall Street Journal, as Paul Craig Roberts points out, most of the April job gain, 72% of it, is in domestic services, with education and health services, primarily health care and social assistance, and waitresses and bartenders accounting for 55,000 jobs, or 42% of the total job gain. Financial activities, he notes, added 26,000 jobs, and professional business services added 28,000. Retail trade actually lost 36,000 jobs. He says the total job gain for the 64-month period from January 2001 when George W. Bush took office and began his insane economic policies. Now, that, I added that part. That's not from Paul Craig Roberts. Yeah, I'll just read it straight. The total job gain for the 64-month period from January 2001 through April 2006 is 7 million jobs fewer than the 9,600,000 jobs necessary to stay even with population growth during that period. Do you get that? 7 million jobs fewer than you need just to stay even. The unemployment rate, Paul Craig Roberts says, is low because millions of discouraged workers have dropped out of the workforce and are not counted as unemployed. He goes on to note, in 2005, the U.S. had a current account deficit in excess of $800 billion. That means Americans consumed $800 billion more in goods and services than they produced. The U.S. pays its current account deficit by giving up ownership of its existing assets or wealth, notes Paul Craig Roberts. Foreigners don't simply hold the $800 billion in cash that we use to buy things from them. They use it to acquire U.S. equities, U.S. real estate, U.S. bonds, and even entire companies. As he says in the headline of his op-ed piece, Paul Craig Roberts, piece that was published yesterday, life in the Bush economy, fat, drunk, and broke. He says, when I was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, the U.S. did not have a trade deficit in manufactured goods. Today, the U.S. has a $500 billion annual deficit in manufactured goods. If the U.S. is doing as well in manufacturing as no-think economists claim, where did an annual trade deficit in manufactured goods of $500 billion come from? Well, it came from Bush policies. And now, in today's Wall Street Journal, we discover what the consequences of this could be. This, we're talking about bite us in the butt big time. As Frederick Kemp, in the Thinking Global column in today's Wall Street Journal, writes, and I'll just share this with you straight up. He says, Frederick Kemp writes, the notion that China and other American rivals could someday use holdings of U.S. debt as a geopolitical weapon is gaining currency, forgive the term, in some quarters. The dramatic growth of global foreign reserves and thus of U.S. debt in the hands of developing countries, frequently undemocratic rivals, has given greater potential leverage to powers already resentful of America's influence. Now, I have to say, I'm really impressed that the Wall Street Journal has finally figured this out. I've only been saying it on this program for 3 years. Frederick Kemp goes on in his column to say, economists speak in particular of the danger that China in defending its vital interests might significantly reduce its buying of U.S. treasuries or sell billions of dollars. And this is exactly what I've been saying. It's China. We owe China so much money. They're holding so much of our debt. And we depend on them to continue buying our debt in order to finance this government. I say we. I mean, you know, it's the United States government. It's the Bush administration, really. I mean, Clinton had us in a surplus. We could make that gesture to the Chinese like Scalia did to the rest of us. You know, I'm talking to you in Sicilian here. But no, not now. Now the Chinese have got us, you know, by those places where if they just squeeze a little bit, we're on our knees. I mean, they're just, they got us. As Frederick Kemp points out in Thinking Global in today's Wall Street Journal, the growing concerns grow out of new International Monetary Fund data showing that official currency reserves of the developing world nearly quadrupled over the past decade to $2.9 trillion last year. Last year alone, he writes, emerging markets reserve holdings, emerging markets being, you know, like China, Saudi Arabia, Russia, reserve holdings grew 18% from the previous year against a 1.5% decline among developed countries. In other words, countries like France and Germany and England, they're not buying our debt. They're actually decreasing the amount of our debt that they're buying, whereas... Well, as Brad Setzer is quoted, director of research at Rabini Global Economics in the Wall Street Journal, he says, the irony is that the three countries in the world adding to reserves the fastest and thus buying the most U.S. debt now are China, Saudi Arabia, and Russia, none of them real democracies. As Frederick Kemp notes, that has put nearly 70% of the global currency reserves, that's, you know, U.S. dollars out there floating around, in developing countries' hands. And then he quotes U.S. Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers, former U.S. Treasury. He says it's a staggering accumulation. He says the total amount of foreign currency reserves has doubled in the past 5 years. Gee, why? Because George Bush is president and the Republicans are in control of the House and Senate. He says, he goes on to say, that's me, that's not Frederick Kemp. Frederick Kemp goes on to say, this radical shift increases the volatility in and decreases the U.S. influence over the world's largest market, the $2 trillion in foreign exchange, the $2 trillion in foreign exchange that changes hands daily. At some point, says Brad Setzer, the director of research at Rabini Global Economics, at some point they could decide the geopolitical calculus no longer favors financing the United States. Ted Truman, Federal Reserve veteran, he says 10 or 15% probability of a catastrophic collapse of the financial system. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Shake it up. Shake it up. And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here on the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, syndicated by Air America Radio. Welcome back to our program. Republican congressional leaders, Brody Mullins writes in today's Wall Street Journal, they are getting their act together, the Republicans in Congress, they are getting their act together to do the really important stuff. They're going to make sure that people who earn their living by waiting for dividend checks to arrive in the mail don't pay as high a tax rate as you and me. Well, to put it in the language of the Wall Street Journal, the Brody Mullins column today, Republican congressional leaders, after weeks of tension between House and Senate tax writers, say they found a way to push a bill through Congress this week to extend lower tax rates on capital gains and dividends. Isn't this exciting? He goes on to say party leaders, including Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist of Tennessee, pressured tax writers to send the first bill to the president's desk. The legislation would extend for 2 years the 15% rates on capital gains and dividends from the end of 2008 until through 2010. You see the special 15% tax rate for millionaires and billionaires, for people who live on income from investments? They pay a maximum income tax of 15% because they're a different class of people, you understand. It expires in 2008 right now. And you've got a whole lot of millionaires and billionaires, folks like Dick Cheney. I mean, look at this year, what, he paid millions of dollars in income tax? Or he got actually got a, what, $6 million income tax refund? Good work if you can get it. Right, when you get the Treasury writing you a check for $6 million? Folks like that, you know, they shouldn't pay more than 15%, according to Republican thinking, because they're morally superior. After all, it's hard work being the ruling class. The bill, Brody Mullins notes, also includes a provision backed by General Electric Company that exempts foreign subsidiaries of U.S. financial service firms from paying U.S. taxes on certain income earned abroad. This is amazing. You know, the Wall Street Journal just kind of lays this stuff out. They just say, General Electric, they wanted to get a few million bucks in tax breaks, and so they just wrote it into the bill, and it's there. And people reading the Wall Street Journal are going, oh, yeah, well, it's good. I'll have to be sure to buy some more General Electric stock, yes. He also notes that the bill would allow wealthy Americans to convert their retirement savings into Roth IRAs. Now, for those of you who aren't millionaires or billionaires, a Roth IRA is a type of retirement account on which, after you die, there is no tax. It's a cool way around the inheritance tax, around the estate tax. Now, when you convert your IRA into a Roth IRA, you do pay a tax, a small tax, upon that conversion. But after that, that's it. And so the Republicans are trying to sell this by saying, well, you know, we've got this huge deficit. The government's running out of money. We need to get some cash. And so if we allow wealthy people to move large chunks of money into Roth IRAs, because right now it's capped at frankly, I don't recall the cap. I don't qualify for one. They're capped at something like $10,000 or $20,000 a year, and they want to make them a couple hundred thousand or maybe a million, who knows what. But they say if we allow wealthy people to move a lot of money into Roth IRAs, that's going to be taxed when it gets moved into the Roth IRAs, and we'll see an increase in government revenues. Well, as Brody Mullins writes in today's Wall Street Journal, critics have said this would raise money for the Treasury in the short term, but would cost the government far more in the future because money saved in a Roth IRA is not taxed when withdrawn. Whereas a normal IRA, you pay taxes on the money when you take it out, and you pay taxes at presumably the lower rate because you're retired. Well, millionaires and billionaires don't ever have a lower rate because they always have their, you know, millions and billions, and their income coming in from their dividends and investments and interest and whatnot. And so you move it into a Roth IRA, right? So once again, the Republicans saying, yeah, let's make decisions that over the short term might make things look better and over the long term are going to totally screw this country. And they are going to be bragging about this because they're attaching a change in the alternative minimum tax to this, which is something that hits people who are making, you know, I don't recall the exact threshold, but it's something like $70,000, $80,000, $90,000. If you make more than that, then you have to pay the alternative minimum tax, which is a lot of families. Because if people, you know, if you've got a married couple and they're both making $50,000 a year, that's $100,000 income for the family, or even $30,000 and $50,000 or whatever. And so you've got a lot of American families. You know, basically the kind of middle class and upper middle class white bread suburbs of America who are now having to pay the alternative minimum tax because it wasn't indexed to inflation. It was originally a tax on wealthy people who don't pay taxes. And the Republicans want to do away with this because it'll be politically popular. And so this is going to be sold as we're solving the problem of the alternative minimum tax. But by the way, we're going to extend the Roth IRA for millionaires and billionaires. And we're going to make sure that the 15% maximum tax rate for people who are in their living, sitting on the butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, extends from 2008 through 2010. And GE is going to exempt subsidiaries of GE, financial service subsidiaries, from paying U.S. taxes on some of the income they earn abroad. But don't look behind that curtain. Just look at the fact that we're cleaning up the alternative minimum tax. Aren't these Republicans great? It's amazing. 27 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman program. The place where we ask, is Walmart a person? No. Party. And the DLC Democrats. the Democrats who are in bed with them. Warren Buffett, the second richest man in the world, behind Bill Gates. And Warren Buffett made his money, a lot of his money, by investing. So arguably the smartest investor in the world, certainly the most successful investor in the world, let's say, owns this company, Berkshire Hathaway, which is basically an investment. You can buy stock in his company, and then his company buys other companies. And that's it's like over $10,000 a share right now to buy into Berkshire Hathaway, but to become part of this. And Warren Buffett has concluded, if his behaviors are any indication, has concluded that Bush is driving us into the ground. The article in yesterday's Wall Street Journal by Karen Richardson and Alistair Barr, Buffett continues to cast his view further abroad for acquisition. He's not buying U.S. anymore. Dateline Omaha, Nebraska, Berkshire Hathaway Inc. is likely to buy more companies overseas, partly because Chairman Warren Buffett thinks the dollar could weaken significantly. Mr. Buffett says he hopes to buy whole companies someday in Japan. They're sitting on $45 billion in cash, and he's trying to get it out of dollars as fast as he can. Late last year, Mr. Buffett trimmed Berkshire's more than $21 billion, invested in foreign exchange contracts, and started buying more foreign stocks, they note in the Wall Street Journal. The continuing weakness of the dollar, despite higher rates, strengthened his view that Berkshire needed to invest in companies and securities overseas to protect itself from a possible sharp fall in the greenback. Mr. Buffett blamed, as he has in the past, the growing current account deficit, that's also known as the trade deficit, in the U.S., and the country's trade imbalance with other nations, such as China, which could cause a painful correction in the dollar and lead to significantly higher inflation. He said the more you owe, the more it becomes attractive to devalue your currency in which your debts are denominated. And then, you know, you flip the page in the Wall Street Journal, and here's another headline. Fed meeting could arm bears with more anti-dollar ammo after a week of severe punishment. The dollar can look forward to more of the same this week. The dollar's declines in the past few weeks have been some of the sharpest seen lately, with the U.S. currency notching a 6% fall against the euro in the past 6 weeks. Amazing. As I've been saying all along, I've been saying this for, I'm starting to sound like, well, I remember back in the old days. I sound like one of those folks. I've been saying this for a while now. The price of commodities is not going up. Copper's not going up. Gold is not going up. Oil is going up. The dollar is going down. In a flat world, in the world that Thomas Friedman wants us to live in the world that the DLC Democrats, Rahm Emanuel, and Evan Bayh want us to live in the world that the Republicans want us to live in, the United States has to become significantly poorer in order for multinational corporations to become wealthier. And make no mistake about it, that's what it's all about. It's not about the UN, it's not even about China, it's about multinational corporations. Meanwhile, CNN reports today, Jeff Green over at CNN, an estimated 2 million babies die within their first 24 hours each year worldwide, and the United States has the second worst newborn mortality rate in the developed world, according to a new report. American babies are three times more likely to die in their first month as children born in Japan, and newborn mortality is 2.5 times higher in the United States than in Finland, Iceland, or Norway, save the children researchers found. Only Latvia, with 6 deaths per 1,000 live births, has a higher death rate for newborns than the United States, which is tied near the bottom of industrialized nations, along with Hungary, Malta, Poland, and Slovakia, at 5 deaths per 1,000 births. The annual State of the World Mothers Report, the United States has more neonatologists and more neonatal intensive care beds per person than Australia, Canada, and the United Kingdom, but its newborn rate is higher, death rate is higher than any of those countries. Why? Well, could it have something to do with the fact that we're the only one of these countries that has a for-profit healthcare system? The only one where families like Bill Frist's family can become billionaires? On the back of illness? And in the meantime, we're living on borrowed money. As they write in The Guardian, the U.S. federal debt stands at $8.2 trillion. Yes, T with a trillion. A trillion with a T. Meaning ordinary Americans' mortgages and such debts, they're even greater. $11 trillion. The concept of savings has all but disappeared in the United States. This is how they look at us from outside, right? This is from a U.K. paper. Last year, the personal savings rate hit its lowest level since 1933 during the Great Depression. The average American household now owes $8,000 in debt on credit cards alone. And they think they own their homes, and they think they own their cars, but in most cases, they're owned by banks. We have to wake up and do something about this. I mean, this is just an absolute mess. An absolute mess. And in the meantime, you know, what is the Senate up to? Well, what is the House up to? June 6th, the Senate's going to vote on whether or not to send a constitutional amendment to the states to ban gay marriage. We have the second highest death rate of newborns in the world among developed countries, and the Senate's response is to ban gay marriage. We have a nation in absolute screaming debt, and the Federal Reserve Bank's the Fed's response to this is to stop publishing M3, the number that tells you the extent to which they're running the printing presses to inflate our currency and depreciate its value. This is the absolute logical outcome of Reaganomics, of trickle-down economics, of conservative economics, of world-is-flat economics, of WTO NAFTA-GATT economics. And now Hillary Clinton is engaged in a mating ritual with Rupert Murdoch? I kid you not. This Rupert Murdoch, this from Drudge of all places. Rupert Murdoch is preparing to support Hillary Clinton. Man, the world has flipped upside down. It has absolutely flipped upside down. Ed in San Juan, California. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom. Just today, supposedly, it was on ABC this morning, one of the morning programs, the Senate is supposed to be voting on, and I'm not trying to blindside you, a bill that would eliminate women getting mammograms yearly and children having checkups, just, you know, general checkups,
mm-hmm.
so that the insurance companies can lower their prices to employers since they won't have to be on the line for mammograms, yearly mammograms and stuff like that. I can't think of the word now. Sorry, too much.
Preventative, are you talking about preventative medicine?
Preventative medicine for children and for women, and they're voting on it today.
Oh, now, Ed, this is really weird because you would think that the insurance companies would know better than that. I mean, for example, I have dental insurance where I have to do a copay if I get any, you know, like teeth drilled or any of that kind of thing. But if I go in to have my teeth cleaned two or three times a year, it's free because they know that if you get your teeth cleaned regularly, you need fewer, you know, cavities drilled out. They actually save money because of preventative health. And, you know, if you look over the lifetime of a human being, preventative medicine reduces health care costs. How can these guys pitch this?
I have no earthly idea, Tom. I just went through a quadruple bypass, and believe me, they didn't want to deal with that. They told me to go home until I got sicker.
Holy cow.
And I had four 100% closures and an over 80% on the next one.
Yeah.
And now I have blood clots on top of it, and they're telling me don't worry just because you can't breathe.
Oh,
so,
man.
Tom, health care is really pathetic.
The health care system in this country is absolutely...
But they're trying to vote for the poor people. Get them out of there.
Yeah. Ed,
sorry,
thank you.
You know, I just wanted to put it out there for you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. It's one I missed. Good on you. Thanks
day.
A lot, Ed. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's on your mind today?
Well, you know, the guest you had on about the unison of homosexuals and marriage.
Yeah.
I'd have to say this. This should be the paramount concern of all of us that have our eyes open and our minds open. And in my opinion, Tom, in the history of the world, there has never been a more destructive unison of marriage than the marriage of the morally an ethically bankrupt wealthy elite and the devastation left behind in the wake of their global agenda.
Okay, I think you might be being a little too subtle for some of our listeners, people who are like, you know, driving down the street and they got distracted by the traffic light. What you're saying, Armin, is that we should ban marriage between conservatives?
What I'm saying is the most powerful that do not have any morality or any ethics, but just raw power and a consensus between themselves, have done more destruction and damage to the future of this country and the past of this country than any other unison of marriage between any other group in the history of the world.
So we shouldn't have allowed. We shouldn't have allowed the merger of these big multinational corporations. Is that the marriage that you're talking about?
Well, that's probably the highest degree of abuse originates from those very corporations, but the CEOs and the major stockholders, the individuals, not the funds. See, they have a really good way, the conservatives, of distorting reality.
Yes.
With a little bit of percentage and the ratios and the math.
No, you're absolutely right, Armin. You're absolutely right, and well said. So the most dangerous kind of marriage is when big corporations get bigger, or when big corporations get in bed with politicians. Bill Frist, George Bush, that kind of stuff. That's what we should be banning. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
You do the walk on life. Welcome back, my friends. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change. By the way, don't miss me as I expose a top secret CIA plan on nationwide television Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern. It's on the Discovery Channel. The title of the show, it was produced by NBC and is playing on the Discovery Channel, 1 hour. The title of the show, Conspiracy Files, JFK Assassination. And I'll be laying out CIA documents about a top-secret plan JFK had and RFK had to stage a coup against Fidel Castro. There are now more than 1 million files still being withheld by our government against the law. Their disclosure is required. But we've nailed this thing down. And it'll be on the Discovery Channel. You can also find a link to it at the top of TomHartman.com. Just go to TomHartman.com, and right up at the very top, you will see Tom on TV Thursday night. And you click there, and it takes you right to the Discovery Channel's website for that particular program. And you can determine when it's going to be playing in your particular locale. Although generally it's 9 o'clock Eastern time, although here in the Pacific time zone, it looks like it's 9 p.m. Pacific time as well. So check out your local time zone. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Don in Seattle. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. We the American people can just discombobulate or blow up the National Security Agency spying program if we just take your advice and exhortations to get involved.
Okay. And how do we get involved by doing that?
Well, all we have to do is email one another right now, or sometime actually periodically, using some keywords that the NASA computer has programmed to pick up and nail the sender as a suspect.
Yeah, you know my problem with that, Don? I actually want my government to be looking for terrorists communicating with each other in email. And if I am, you know, gumming up the works, I don't think that's a good thing. I also want my government to be doing it legally. So I think rather than trying to crash the NSA's computers, we should be working to get the NSA to be operating within the law. And they're not operating outside the law because that's their decision. They're operating outside the law because that's Bush's decision. And he needs to be held accountable for that.
Well, I think the NASA people can probably come up with an alternative system, but if nothing else, it would show Senator Spector that we're not apathetic, that we're angry about this.
Well, I think the way to show him that is not to send emails that say Al-Qaeda, you know, let's bomb LaGuardia or whatever, stuff like that in them. I think the way to do it is to call up Senator Spector's office and say, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. I mean, you know, we've had enough of this stuff.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, I've heard you exhort the American people so many times, and getting involved.
And people respond. People do respond. I mean, we actually have seen, I believe we've seen legislation change as the result of people calling their elected officials. I can't say it's entirely this show. I think it happens when a number of us, you know, get on the same wavelength. But we have seen the American people respond. So, it's kind of a cute idea of, you know, let's blow up their computers by sending around keywords and things. But I'd just rather they had those computers, and those computers worked just fine, but they were being used legally and appropriately. Doesn't that seem to make more sense, Don?
Well, to you and maybe a lot of your listeners, it does. I guess I'll be the only one flagged.
there's a downside to that, too. Don, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. It's good to hear from you. And as Howard Beale said, you know,
you've got to say, I'm a human being. My life has value.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
There you go. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Hello, Tom. Can I take a few minutes to talk about this unbridled capitalism?
Sure.
Enough of this already.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, enough of
laissez-faire capitalism. Roosevelt saved capitalism from itself, and now it's trying to self-destruct again.
Are you strapped in?
I'm strapped in.
Okay. If you don't mind, I'd like to bounce this off you. America's way, way, way too much about money, property, and inherited values. Let's get on with it. Let's get on with, like you say, get active. Here's the analogy. Let me bounce this off you. I know you only have a few minutes. Thank you for taking my call. Here's the analogy I like to make. A great man who was a father figure many, many years ago. Make it short, if I can. Sometimes I get along with
him. We have about 40 seconds, Gary.
Yeah, and he said to me, Gary, this is back in the 70s, Gary, if you have your physical and mental health, you already made your first $1 million. You already made your first $1 million. Forget about it.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. The analogy is to America. If we have our fiscal budget health, we have a healthy environment, we have a sound Medicare and Medicaid, reasonably sound, we've already won $100 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
We've lost perspective.
Yeah, we really have. We really have, Gary. And I think
Thank you.
Yeah, you did that in less than 40 seconds. I'm impressed. And, you know, you make a good point, and I think it's a point that all of us need to be paying attention to. It's just, you know, very straightforward fashion that there are things that are important. And the fundamental values that we find even in our religions, you know, the fundamental values of family, of community, we need to be coming back to these things and saying, you know, what's really important? Is it really important that millionaires and billionaires be able to make twice as much money? Is that our highest priority? I mean, I get it that there's people who believe that if that's the case, then society will be best served. I believe they're wrong. History shows that they're wrong. But, you know, let's just, you know, Franklin Roosevelt was the ultimate pragmatist. He said, let's try a lot of things, and some of them aren't going to work, and we'll do away with them. And he tried program after program after program, and some of them he kept, and some of them he discarded. He had the WPA, he had the CCC, he had on and on and on it went. And a lot of them, hey, it didn't work. We'll try something different. We need pragmatists rather than ideologues in politics. We'll be back after the news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
One of the things that has significantly distinguished us from Europe is that in the United States, we inflict things, or we allow corporations to inflict things on the people, and then if people die, we go, oops, can't do that anymore, whereas in Europe, they operate on something called the precautionary principle. Prove that it's safe before you release it. Welcome back to the program. Tom Hartmann here with you, the Tom Hartmann Radio Program, syndicated by Air America Radio. Debbie Raphael is with us, program manager for the City and County of San Francisco's Toxics Reduction and Green Building Programs. This is our Bioneers segment for the week. Bioneers, a nonprofit organization founded in 1990 that promotes practical environmental solutions and environmental and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. You can find their website at bioneers.org. And Debbie Raphael's website, sfenvironment.org. Debbie, the precautionary principle in the United States?
Isn't that a concept? You know, as working in government like I do, I look for inspiration in unusual places. And it's heartwarming to know that there is something in the way of inspirational, truly inspirational and transformational legislation. And that is where the precautionary principle comes in. And your summary is absolutely correct. In this country, you know, we let things on the market. We allow companies to make profits on chemicals and products. And then once they're out in the environment and in our homes, we say, oh, my goodness, look what's happened. We have lead in our gasoline and paint. We have mercury in thermometers. We have asbestos in our homes. Now we're going to have to figure out how to clean it up and solve the health problems that are a result.
But see, that is useful from the point of view of pure capitalism. That's actually a useful way to do things, because if you put lead in the people's paint, then you make profit doing that, and then you have an opportunity to make profit taking that leaded paint out of their houses later. Plus, the healthcare industry has an opportunity to make profit. I mean, Bill Frist's debt is worth billions as a result of our private healthcare, our privatized for-profit healthcare industry. You have the healthcare industry able to provide services to children who have been damaged by lead or chelating the lead out of them, and you have the educational industry to the extent that that's actually the one sector of this that is not entirely privatized. In fact, it's still probably mostly public, but there are still opportunities to make a little money there as well with special needs private schools for children who have been neurologically damaged by lead. And so everybody gets to make money on these kinds of things. And the precautionary principle, on the other hand, would say, no, you can't do that. You know, it's not a good idea. So how do you push this thing in a laissez-faire capitalist world that's increasingly being run by right-wingers who believe that corporate profits should be above everything else?
Well, in San Francisco, we're saying no to that. We are saying that there is a better way, and we have found that better way, and we're going to try and make our government decisions based on that precautionary approach. So here's what a precautionary approach does, is it says we need to ask the question, is something really necessary? Because where we are right now, the way we've gotten to that scenario that you've just explained, is we only asked two questions. We asked the question, is it legal? And that makes the assumption that there is some government agency protecting us from all things bad. And I think we all know that those protections are not in place. And then what industry found out is a better question that they can get us in is it safe? Is it safe? And what will happen when communities and industry engage in a discussion of is something safe? Is it safe to put mercury in vaccines? Is it safe to put high fructose corn syrup in everything we eat? What happens is you'll get the scientific community engaged, and you'll get 6 inches right thick of science saying something is safe, 6 inches thick of science saying something is not safe, and then what industry says to government is, well, look, it's inconclusive. You cannot prove harm. Therefore, the answer is more study. More study, more study, which leads to inaction. And what the precautionary principle says is that it is no longer sufficient to ask, is something legal or is it safe? Instead, we ask, is it necessary? Do we have to have mercury in our vaccines as a preservative? Do we have to build play structures out of wood that contains arsenic, a known carcinogen? Do we have to put pesticides on our park? Is it necessary? Hmm. And when you ask that question, that whole cycle that you described falls apart.
Well, unless you assume that anything that drives economic activity is necessary. And I'm telling you, the Bush and Republican right wingers really and truly believe that. You get these guys, they're true believers in this.
And therefore, the most important voice in that is industry who makes the alternatives. If we can engage the green chemists, the people who are making the solar panels, who are making wood that isn't treated with arsenic, but with something that doesn't cause cancer, and demonstrate the profit opportunity for them, then we're engaging the capitalist system in a precautionary approach. So I believe, and in San Francisco we believe, that it is pro-innovation, not anti-business, to do a precautionary approach.
I absolutely agree. I think it's brilliant, Debbie Raphael, that you've done this. SFenvironment.org, the website. I want to play just a short clip. This is a 30-second spot that Adbusters produced a number of years ago, actually, that I think really defines this, and I'd like to get your response to this. Just, you know, give you something to bounce off of.
Here we go.
For years, economists have defined the economic health of a country by its gross domestic product. Trouble is, every time a forest falls, the GDP goes up. With every oil spill, the GDP goes up. Every time a cancer patient is diagnosed, the GDP goes up. Is this how we measure economic progress? Economists must learn to subtract.
Isn't that brilliant?
It is. I couldn't hear it perfectly, but my guess is the gist of it is that we're gauging our GDP. Our GDP goes up at human misfortune.
Yeah, it starts out by saying that we use GDP as a measure of economic health.
Right.
And then he says the trouble is every time there's an oil spill, GDP goes up because, you know, there's economic activity involved in cleaning it up. Every time a forest falls, GDP goes up. Every time cancer is diagnosed, GDP goes up. In fact, a cancer diagnosis right now is worth on average $250,000 to the healthcare industry.
Wow.
And then he says, you know, if we're going to save ourselves, economists must learn to subtract. And it seems to me that that's essentially the message that you're saying, that we must use a different criteria than economic progress to define what's a healthy society.
And, you know, that is an interesting point, because a lot of people are trying to put numbers on, in order to combat that, so to measure economic health based on the health of our natural resources and putting a dollar value on conservation and on wetlands that are filtering pollutants and forests that are taking out CO2. So they're, and I don't know if that's the answer. I don't know if the answer is...
It's almost buying into the same game.
It is almost buying into the same game, rather than saying, as you put it, that subtraction is the issue.
Yeah.
That this, and really, healthcare, of all people, have been talking about prevention and the idea that prevention is better than trying to figure out cures. And in a sense, that's what the precautionary principle is saying as well. If we can prevent the problem to begin with, then those same resources that are being used in our government structure to clean up could be used to create jobs, perhaps, in another way that's more positive.
But as long as we have a for-profit healthcare system, there's going to be more emphasis on creating new drugs than there is going to be on preventing type 2 diabetes, for example. And I think it's really interesting that you're coming out of a world. I mean, you're coming out of the world of government, right, in San Francisco. Government is part of the commons. Government is not for profit. Government is we the people serving we the people. And so government obviously has a vested interest in diminished costs, increased efficiency, and reduction both short-term and long-term in costs, whereas for-profit agencies, like our healthcare industry in the United States, tragically, because it is for-profit, it is profit-driven, really has a reverse set of incentives.
And perhaps then, as you started out, we need to look at other models for that. And because I work in government, that's where I think about some of my solutions. And I think about the role of government along with partnerships, because obviously government alone is very ineffective. So how can we in government and industries that are doing the right thing, what kind of systems can we set up in this country that serve capitalism in the sense that we're not trying to put people out of business and we want to create jobs and at the same time are regenerative to our health and our natural resources? And one of the problems is that we don't have incentives, the right set of governmental incentives for industry to reformulate and give us the healthier products.
Right.
In Europe right now, they are developing something called REACH, which it's a regulation for chemicals policy that is very much has the precautionary principle as its underpinnings, and the A in the word REACH is authorization.
Yeah, and this all goes back to really revisioning.
Revisioning.
You know, re-understanding, you know, what the commons, what we're all about here. But Debbie, thank you so much for being with us. Debbie Raphael, she's the program manager for the City and County of San Francisco's Toxics Reduction and Green Buildings Program. You can read all about it at sfenvironment.org. Debbie, thank you.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Neil Young, let's impeach the president. 22 minutes past the hour in the Darwinian world of ideas. We're at the top of the food chain here on the Tom Hartman program. And no, it's not the... I'm really not trying to sound like Lee Raymond.
Come here, I'm going to eat you. I'm bigger than you. I'm higher in the food chain.
No. Sorry about that. Welcome back to our program. Taking the E out of EPA. No, I'm not kidding. I am not kidding. This from PEER.org, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. On May 1st, 2006, that's like last week, EPA Administrator Stephen Johnson announced that Tom Dunn would serve as the agency's first Associate Administrator for Homeland Security and will report directly to Johnson, who has also created a National Security and Intelligence Center in the new Homeland Security Office. In addition, the Bush administration has proposed channeling $45 million out of the EPA into a Water Sentinel program to help monitor water infrastructure safety in the event of a terrorist attack. Say what? The EPA is supposed to protect the environment. I mean, this is incredible. The executive director, Jeff Rutsch, the executive director of PEER, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, he says the EPA is cannibalizing its children. They're cannibalizing their public health functions in order to run programs that should be paid for by the Department of Homeland Security, an organization that is not suffering from a lack of funding. We do not need EPA researchers playing junior G-men. This is from an organization made up of government employees who are concerned about the environment. At the same time these new security functions are being expanded, EPA's overall budget is being cut. The budgetary axe is falling on traditional environmental programs, such as those designed to improve water quality. EPA is also closing most of its libraries as a cost-saving measure. The agency claims that it lacks funding to collect data, conduct cumulative effect analyses, and develop standards for determining the level of neurotoxicity of pesticides that the EPA is approving for commercial use. So they can't tell us if the pesticides that they're approving are going to cause our children to be physically or mentally stunted or damaged because they don't have enough money. But they can set aside $45 million to have EPA researchers, instead of looking for pesticides in the waterways of our country, looking for terrorists. I am not making this up. As the executive director of PURE wrote, it is unconscionable that EPA is certifying pesticides as safe without doing the basic research to determine their effects on growing children. Meanwhile, EPA is now, as of last week, now has its own Homeland Security function. Mind-boggling. Nancy, listening on WPTT in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Nancy, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm hoping to shed a little light on a gentleman's call earlier about the Senate bill that's going to minimize our health insurance coverage.
Right.
It's called Senate Bill 1955. I believe Senator Enzi from Wyoming is the one that cooked this idea up. It was to allow small businesses to band together to offer health insurance. That's what's written in the
big
print.
It's called the Health Insurance Modernization Act.
Yeah, that's what's written in the big print. What's written in the small print is that it's going to preempt the state's right for minimum coverage requirements. So we will lose things such as well baby care checks, childhood immunizations, pap smears, prostate screening, diabetes supplies.
Right, and supporters of this bill are trying to force a vote to invoke cloture. It requires 60 votes. So right now, people should be calling their senators and saying,
yes,
and stop this thing. Senate Bill 1955, and the toll-free telephone number for Congress is 1-888-355-3588. 1-888-355-3588. 3588. That reaches all members of the United States. This is actually in the Senate. So ask for one of your two senators and then call the other one of your two senators.
Thanks. If you could keep on this.
That will do. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. And Nancy, thanks so much for listening to us in Pittsburgh there on WPTT.
Thanks.
27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where reason is our lifestyle choice.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Looking for a leader to bring our country home. Reunite the red, white, and blue before it turns to stone. Looking for somebody dumb enough to take it on. Clean up the corruption and make the country strong.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. Get the latest iPods, all things Macintosh, all things computer. Great help. Fine people. Give them a call and tell them I said hi. 1-800-511-MAX. Well, you know, buy something, too, please. 35 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. KJ in Camas, Washington. Hey, KJ, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom, you're the guest you had at the beginning of the show, I actually got two issues here. These people who say that homosexual behavior is a choice.
Yeah.
Considering that humans have this need to be accepted, why, logically, would anyone choose to be an outcast? I mean, that doesn't even make sense.
Well, that was the point that I made to him. You know, why would not just be an outcast? I mean, to be the subject of social, economic, all different kinds of discrimination. You know, why? Why would somebody do that unless there was some biological imperative?
Yeah. And the other topic I wanted to bring up related is family models, you know, about the so-called traditional nuclear family, which,
mm-hmm.
you know, considering the divorce rate and the single parents, there is another model that nobody talks about. It's called consanguineal. Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not. Well, tell me.
A woman, in there are some cultures, and most of these, I believe, in Africa, a woman raises her child with her brother rather than the biological family. And it doesn't mean they're having sex. In fact, the whole point is that they're not having sex. The point is that blood is thicker than water, and your brother is not going to, you know, I guess they acknowledge that sexual relationships are probably going to be temporary, but the child needs a man in their family, so why not the maternal uncle?
Who's I know in some cultures that I've visited, some Aboriginal cultures that I've hung out with, the grandparents do most of the child rearing. And the people who are of childbearing age are doing the hunting. They're doing the work. They're out there, you know, whether it's in northern Uganda, the Keremajong, you know, herding cattle and whatnot, or whether it's you know, some of the people up in way up north in Canada, some of the Inuit people. You find that a lot of the child rearing, maybe a majority of the child rearing, is being done by grandparents rather than by, and that just makes sense. You know,
and through most of human history, haven't families been extended rather than nuclear? I mean, isn't that kind of an aberration?
Yeah. In fact, even in recent history, I remember the first time that I traveled through Northern Europe, the first time I traveled through Europe, I was amazed to see houses that just kind of went on forever. You know, I mean, you could see the additions as the generations, you know, these multi-generational houses that are still multi-generational houses. You get to know these folks. You know, there's part of the house where this family lives, and then, you know, the grandparents are in this part, and the kids are in that part, and, you know, all that kind of thing. I mean, they've just kind of added on as time went on. And you see that also in a lot of the rural areas in the United States, frankly.
Yeah, and personally, I think that child raising is a horrible burden to place on just two people. I mean, you know, the idea of taking a village to raise a family, I think that is absolutely true.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. And I have to say, as somebody who helped, who participated in raising three children, and Louise and I had our three kids when we were in our 20s.
Ooh.
You know, I mean, our first child was born when I was 23 and Louise was 21, as I recall. And we were children having children.
Yeah.
I look back on it. I have friends who are my age who are in their 50s and who are now raising children, you know, who have young children. And they're such better parents than I was. You know, it's like there is something to be said for, you know, wisdom. We made the decision to strike out on our own and go off and leave Lansing, Michigan, where the rest of my family is. And my brothers didn't. And one of my brothers, in fact, their two children were largely participatorily raised by my parents, you know, their grandparents. And I think that they're very healthy for that. I won't say that they're healthier than my kids. Who knows? But I think it was a good thing looking at it.
You probably did something right, Tom.
Yeah. Well, you know, I did, you know, we all do stuff right. We all do stuff wrong. I mean, we all have things we're proud of and things we regret. But KJ, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Bill in Sacramento, California. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hi, how you doing?
I'm great. I'll get better.
Show, man. You're a lifesaver for the American public.
Well, thank you, Bill. And thanks for listening on KSAC there in Sacramento.
Oh, yeah. Hey, I'd like to kind of change the subject a little bit. But,
sure.
I'm concerned because every time this group gets in and gets a stronghold on our government and the White House, they raid our U.S. Treasury.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously it's an easy target because you can siphon billions and trillions of dollars off.
Yep.
And the military complex comes, you know, military comes back into the White House. This has been going on ever since we created this thing called the National Security Council, which this current guy Hayden is part of, by the way.
Yeah.
But so all these names keep coming up every time, and this has been going on ever since just before Nixon got in, and while Bush's father was CIA, and so. I'm really concerned that if Hayden I think for Hayden to be appointed, he should have to give up his military commission because as a commissioned military person, his oath is to the commander in chief, not protecting the Constitution.
No, actually, his oath is to the Constitution.
Well, yeah,
as an officer,
but his loyalty.
But his, you know, his practical, you know, his obviously his practical loyalty is to Bush. I mean,
General Secord and Ollie North, right?
yeah, exactly. Well, and just get this, Bill. This is the Fourth Amendment specifically says that you have to have you have to believe that somebody probably committed a crime before you go busting into their house, or electronically before you go busting into their telephones or their email box.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it says it is quite simple. The probable cause is the thing that triggers search warrants and arrest warrants.
Right.
The Fourth Amendment, I'll read it, the entire sentence here. It's a one-sentence amendment.
Mm-hmm.
The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation. In other words, somebody has to swear to it,
mm-hmm.
and particularly describing or specifically describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. In other words, a judge has to listen to testimony and decide that probably there's a crime here. We have probable cause. Now, here is Michael Hayden being interrogated by a member of the press corps. I'm sorry, I don't have the name of the reporter who's asking him these
mm-hmm.
questions, and saying the exact opposite. Listen to this.
But does it not say probable? The court standard, the legal standard is probable cause.
That's the report.
My understanding is that the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution specifies that you must have probable cause.
This is the reporter. He's continuing this question. He keeps saying to the general, you have to have probable cause. You know, how can you have this NSA wiretapping program and listen in on people when you don't have cause to believe that they've committed a crime? And Hayden says, no, no, it just has to be reasonable. And
right.
he's like, it continues.
To be able to do a search that does not violate an American's right against unlawful seizures and searches and seizures.
Now, here comes Hayden's response.
Fourth Amendment actually protects all of us against unreasonable search and seizure.
But the measure is probable cause, I believe.
The amendment says unreasonable search and seizure.
But does it not say probable?
No.
No, he says, does it not say probable cause? No, he says.
Right.
And then he continues.
The court standard, the legal standard is probable cause.
Just to be very clear.
This is Hayden now.
And believe me, if there's any amendment to the Constitution that employees of the National Security Agency are familiar with, it's the Fourth. Right? And it is a reasonableness standard in the Fourth Amendment.
A reasonableness standard. I'm sorry. The Fourth
right.
Amendment says probable cause. You
right.
have to, you know, you, no warrant shall be issued but upon probable cause, sworn to by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place or person or things to be searched.
Right.
I mean, this is, Bill, you're spot on right. And
this group, because I want to take it just a little bit further than Hayden himself, this group is committed to that strategy and that goal of global domination, and if you look at the names, and this is what I would like the American public to realize, this group is like a Hydra organization. They've been together ever since '68, and they're right after the Six Day War and the bombing of the Liberty.
Actually, a lot of them have been together since '64. I mean,
yeah.
They first came together for Goldwater's campaign.
Pollard. It says, I'm reading an article from Executive Intelligence Review. It says Pollard, when his arrest in November 85, he had been tasked to get information from higher-ups that had already infiltrated, and they were looking for Mr. X. In the article it says, but it was really an X committee made up of nearly a dozen top-level Pentagon and National Security Council officials, all suspected of having been part of the Pollard spy network, unquote. You know, and all those people tie back to Bush and this guy Seymour Bolton, B-O-L-T-E-N, which is the guy that's in charge of the White House now is Bolton. That's his father, and they've all been connected to him, and this guy named Ed Rogers, who's part of this New Bridge Strategies document that I sent you about a couple weeks ago with Joe Albaugh.
And let's be clear, this is not some weird kind of, you know, New Age conspiracy thing. It's not some sort of, you know, this is right out in the open. They have a website, newamericancentury.org. I mean, it's the Project for New American Century, one dimension of this whole thing. Yeah, absolutely. The militarization of the United States is exactly what Dwight Eisenhower warned us about in 1961 when he left office. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those nads in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from a field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
And welcome back, my friends. Let us hope that that great Canadian Leonard Cohen is right, that democracy is coming to the USA. I'm looking here at the New York Times commodity page. I just updated a few moments ago. And oil, light sweet crude, up $1.23 to $71 a barrel. Copper was selling for, as I recall, like 38 or 40 cents a pound when Bush came into office. I may be wrong on that, but I don't think I am. It was certainly less than a dollar. Copper, $3.60 a pound, up 9 cents today. Gold, $701.50 an ounce, up $21.60 today. Silver, $14.47 an ounce, up 70 cents today. Now, when Bush came into office, as I recall, silver was around, what, $7, $8 an ounce? Gold was around $2.90? All of these commodities exploding through the roof, and what I have to, and even food. I mean, corn is up $1.238. Soybeans up $5, $604.50. Wheat up $9.25 at $384.75. What all of this says to me, platinum, it went up $37 today. The $1,239 an ounce, I believe it was under $1,000 an ounce when Bush came in. I don't own any. I'm not like super fastidious about the keeping track of exactly the numbers and all these things. But you see all these huge trends and you go, whoa. Is it possible that every single commodity in the world is going up in price, or is it more likely that the dollar is collapsing? That we are watching a slow motion train wreck called the Bush administration, called conservative economics, called Reaganomics, called trickle-down economics. I would say with an absolute certainty the latter is the case, along with the loss of our infrastructure and the loss of our commons as these guys systematically dismantle the structures of government and of the commons that keep us alive, keep us together, and keep our democracy vital. Yeah. Dick in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Dick, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Dick.
How are you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Dick. What's up?
Oh, I was just saying amen to what you said to the democracy. Let it thrive forever, buddy.
Yeah.
I agree with it.
Well, we're going to have to work on it to make that happen, Dick. No, it's not going to happen all by itself.
You come down here and teach these politicians in Ohio that. No, I just want to say about they had something in one of our Ohio papers, how we fail without education, and I believe your business, your political science, and history are your best subjects for the knowledge of learning.
Yeah, and increasingly we're not in our elementary schools. I mean, you're talking about colleges. In our elementary schools, we're not teaching critical thinking any longer. We're not teaching the classics. We're not teaching philosophy. We're not teaching civics.
Right.
We're not teaching music. We're not teaching second languages. And these are the fundamental things that not only produce a well-rounded individual, not only produce the springboard to curiosity and discovering the rest of the world, but also actually help wire children's brains to be more efficient learning machines as they get older. We've given up all of that stuff, whereas all the European countries are aggressively moving in those directions. And instead, we're just saying science and math, science and math, science and math,
right,
because the cons have said, oh, well, we've shipped all your jobs overseas, so you have to learn more science and math. You have to compete with the Indian engineers. That's what it's all about. And it's nonsense. It's a lie.
Now, you know what I believe in? Being from a family of, in Ohio, I'm a musician part-time. I play in a little group that does a lot of patriotic songs, and I saluted you the other night in your show.
Well, thank you.
Have a good day, Tommy.
Thank you, Dick. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Pam in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Pam, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to, first of all, as someone who has been participating in grassroots activism and in my district, and sometimes it gets a little discouraging that there aren't more people involved, I wanted to thank you for being someone who is a voice of reason and encourages people to participate, and it's just so important. And you're just a consistent voice of optimism and, let's do it, and as opposed to just sitting sitting there saying how horrible it is. And so I really appreciate that. And I also am excited that you're going to be in Seattle on the 10th about changing the media and changing America, because to me, what we get fed is just pablum, and it's censored, and it's, I mean, you, if you, if, I mean, sure, you're aware, if we go to any other website that is out of the traditional, we know what other news is actually going on. And and I'm very concerned about what's happening in terms of the conservatives buying up the radio stations out from under, like Air America or other progressive talk radio.
Yeah, although I haven't yet seen any evidence, Pam, this is conservatives. What's happening is there are some formats that are very profitable right now. Christian programming is very profitable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Pat Robertson did not get to be a billionaire by accident.
Mm.
Hispanic radio is the fastest growing format right now in American radio.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got people in Christian broadcasting, for example, the Air America station in Phoenix got bought up by somebody who was going to broadcast Christian. It was a money decision. The Christian broadcasters could pay more money for the station. And there have been a few other stations that have gone to Spanish language radio, and not just from this format. I mean, you've had conservative stations be sold for those formats as well. The competition for the frequencies is getting more intense.
On
the other hand, you've got things coming along like HD radio, high definition radio, that are opening it up. You know, and satellite radio they're gonna give satellite radio a run for their money. Plus, there's podcasting and everything else. Pam, I got to run. Thank you for the call. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. Great to hear from you. And I look forward to seeing you when I get there to Seattle in a month, I think it is. I hope I have my calendar right. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be challenging conservative Sam Kasman, who says that the only problem about pharmaceuticals entering the market is deadly overcaution. Yeah, right. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Call your senator now. And tell them you don't want them messing with the ability of the states to guarantee health care. You don't want them messing with Senate Bill 1955. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.